Ready? Hello, good afternoon. Yes, thank you. Thank you. It's nice to be inside on a day like this, isn't it? Yeah. I'd like to begin with two health and safety poems. First one called In Case of Fire. In case of fire, break glass. In case of glass, fill with water. In case of water, wear heavy boots. In case of heavy boots, assume fetal position. In case of fetal position, loosen clothing. In case of clothing, avoid nudist beach. In case of nudist beach, keep sand out of eyes. In case of eyes, close curtains. In case of curtains, switch on light. In case of light, embrace truth. In case of truth, spread word. In case of word, keep mum. In case of mum, open arms. In case of arms, lay down gun. In case of gun, fire. In case of fire, thank you. The next one's about mobile phones. Obviously, it's better if they're switched off, unless you're expecting a call. But they can be irritating, can't they? I know when I get on a train, I always go into the quiet coach, you know, the quiet zone, you know, mobile free. And I was coming back from Bristol a couple of years ago, got on the train, empty train at Bristol, sat down in the quiet zone, and this lady got on and sat opposite me, got out a mobile phone, yap. So I tried to draw her attention to all these notices, but she ignored it. So I thought, what shall I do, go and nudge her or take a phone away? I'd write her a poem. So I wrote her this poem. With respect, this is a quiet zone. And although when traveling on your own, it's nice to have a good old chat with someone on the phone, this is a quiet zone. Shh, quiet, say the signs on every table, window and door. Obviously nothing to do with mobiles, so what do you think they're for? A warning perhaps to brass bands looking for a place to rehearse. To the horde of angry soccer fans who need to stamp and curse. A troop of soldiers on the march, tramp, tramp or worse. A stampede of trumpeting elephants. A disruptive class of kids. The entire cast of Stomp banging dustbin lids. A volcano bursting to erupt an unexploded mine. Shh, quiet, with respect. Can't you read the sign? Thank you. Funny enough, we'd reached Reading by the time I'd finished that poem. It takes time to write this. And by which time she'd stopped chatting on the phone, just looking out the window. So I thought I'd give her the poem anyway. You know, nice thing. She just went up and said, I wrote this for you. And do you know what she did? She got out her mobile phone, all the way to bloody Paddington. She just rang up and told all the phone the poem. In Japanese, yeah. I thought I'd do something very bold. And I said some poems about memory. And I thought I'd start with a poem that I've just written, or I don't know whether it's finished yet. It's one of those times, you know, you just write a poem, you don't know where it fits in or what it is. But it's about a memory, a very early memory. It's true. It's called Another Place. Another Place is the term given to Anthony Gormley's statues up in Liverpool, on the coast in Liverpool, Formby. You know, these statues staring out to sea. So the poem's called Another Place. A summer's day on the beach at Seaforth. There is a war on, so sunshine is rationed, and the sea half a mile away, never more than a wet promise. Unmanned pillboxes gaze sullenly out over the Mersey. Rotting dragon's teeth, half submerged, wait to repel enemy tanks. Crabs scuttle across minefields. A three-year-old follows the ball as it bounces over the wire and skims across the sand windswept, light as a balloon. A girl, still in her teens, finds the gap in the barbed wire and races after him, scoops him up, and bursts into tears. The area had been cordoned off, and the Ministry of Defense signs made clear the danger. But little boys can't read, and balls are there for the chasing. Now there's a time switch. A summer's day with Auntie Kath on the beach at Crosby, where a platoon of Gormley's Iron Men are now stationed. Has she any recollection of running across a minefield to rescue me all those years ago? Or is my imagination playing tricks? A scene, perhaps, from a film half recalled. "All true," she says. "You gave us the fright of our lives, running off like that." "It was the big red rubber ball," I said. "I remember chasing after it in the wind." My aunt stopped. "Red rubber ball? There was no ball. You were following the dog. You remember Goldie?" A golden retriever finds a gap in the barbed wire and races across the sand. Suddenly, an explosion. The dog obliterated in one ear-splitting instant. The child turned into an iron statue. Eyes tightly shut, he watches the red ball bounce harmlessly into the distance. It's really about the way the mind actually, I don't remember, this is a true story, and I do remember in my mind's eye chasing after a ball, and apparently it was the dog. And it's so how the mind can close off things. Anyway, thank you. I had lots of aunties. It's lucky for a poet, actually, to have lots of aunties. My mum was a family of 13 in the family, 15 in the family, mainly aunties, and my dad was one of nine. So I had lots of aunties. This is a very favourite auntie, and what became of her. And as the poem says, she loved playing cards, and there's a reference to poker. Any poker players out there? You all know about a full house, don't you? Three cards, two, you know all that, don't you? Yes. Anyway, here's a poem called Hearts and Flowers. Auntie Marge, spinster of the parish, never had a boyfriend. Never courted, never kissed. A jerry-built dentist and a smashed jaw, sort of that. To her, life was a storm in a holy water font, across which she breezed with all the grace and charm of a giraffe learning to windsurf. But sweating in the convent laundry, she would iron amices, albums, and surplices with such tenderness and care, you'd think priests were still inside. Deep down, she would like to have been a nun, and talked of missing her vocation as if it were the last bus home. "It passed me by when I was looking the other way. Besides," she'd say, "what order would have me? The little daughters of the bingo? The holy whist sisters? A glance at the ceiling. He's not that hard up." We'd laugh and protest, knowing in our hearts that he wasn't. But for the face, she would have been out there, married, five kids, another on the way. Celibacy, a gift unearned, unasked for. But though a goose among grown-ups, let loose among kids, she was an exploding fireworks factory, a runaway pantomime horse. Everybody's favourite aunt, a cuddly toy adult that sang loud and out of tune, that dropped, knocked over, and bumped into things. They got ticked off, just like us. Next to a game of cards, she liked babysitting best. Once the parents were out of the way, it was every child for itself. In charge, Aunt Marge, renegade toddler-in-chief. Falling asleep over pontoon, my sister and I, red-eyed, would beg to be taken to bed. "Just one more game of snap," she'd plead, and magic two toffees from behind an ear. Then suddenly whooshed upstairs in the time it takes to open a front door. Leaving us to possum, she'd tiptoe down with the fortnightly fib. Still fast asleep, not a murmur all night, little angels. But angels, unangelic, grew up and flew away, and fallen looked for brighter toys. Each Christmas sent a card with kisses and wondered how she coped alone up there in a council flat, no phone. Her death was as quick as it was clumsy. Neighbours found the body, not us. sitting there for days, stiff in Sunday best, coat half-buttoned, hat askew, on her way to Mass, late as usual. Her rosary had snapped with the pain, the decade spilling, black beads trailing, the crucifix still clenched in her fist, middle finger broken, branded into the dead flesh, the sign of the cross. From the missal in her lap, holy pictures like playing cards lay scattered. Five were face-up, a full house of sacred hearts and little flowers. Auntie Marge, lucky in cards. Thank you. Thank you. Talking about how I learned to read many years ago in Liverpool. Learning to read during the war wasn't easy, as books were few and far between. But Mother made sure I didn't go to sleep without a bedtime story. Because of the blackout, the warm, comforting glow of a bedside lamp was not permitted. So Mum would pull back the curtains and open wide the window. And by the light of a blazing factory or a crashed Messerschmitt, cuddled up together, she would read sauce bottles, jam jars, and my all-time favourite, a tin of Ovaltine. So many years ago, but still I remember her gentle guidance as I read aloud my first sentence. Sprinkle 2 heaped teaspoons full of Ovaltine. What if you remember your mum saying this to you when you were little? Bunk on wording thing. You soon grow into it, she would say. When buying a school blazer, 3 sizes too big. And she was right, as mothers usually are. Syrup of figs, Virol, cod liver oil. Within a year, I did grow into it. By then, of course, it was threadbare. Pulling in different directions, my clothes and I never matched. And in changing rooms, nothing has changed. I can buy what I like and when. New clothes that are a perfect fit. Full-length mirror, nervous grin. It's me now that's threadbare, wearing thin. Ah, yeah. I've been reading about, trying to get new electric cars, with no carbon emissions. Very good. And Nissan have developed this new car called the Leaf, which has zero carbon emissions. So I thought that was worth a poem. So ode to the new Nissan zero emission electric car. Cornering too fast, he came to grief. Spun out of control, turned over a new leaf. Sit down to read some poems from the book, new book, and these are addresses where you talk to something directly, something inanimate, as if it were real. And this first one's to bedtime stories, and begins with a little quotation, because one of my books won an award, and this was in the brochure, in the prize-winning thing. How we envy the infant MacGuffs tucked up in bed, night after night of magical word juggling at the hands of a consummate craftsman. How lucky they were. How grateful they must feel. There we are. Sadly, you weren't around when I was a child. In wartime, with blackouts and nightly bombings, the printed word was rationed, and there was little time for ill-fitting glass slippers and transvestite wolves. Sadly, my own books weren't around either. How proud it would have made Mum to read my stories to me, as I joined in the exciting bits and quickly learned the poems off by heart. Because I write for children and often perform with apparent enthusiasm in front of young audiences, people assume I enjoyed reading to my own kids, the bedroom aglow with lilting reassurance. Alas, bedtime stories, I let you down. Grim's the word. I yawned my way through the classics, boring swiftly of fables and fairy tales. I would leave out great chunks. Once upon a time, they lived happily ever after, the end. I blame the war and the clash of opening times and bedtimes. One eye on the smiling Thomas the Tank Engine clock. Gosh, is that the quality time? Good night, sleep tight, kiss, kiss, and Daddy is down the stairs and off to the pub. So inept was I, so famously bad, that when the kids were still making a noise long after lights out, my wife would shout upstairs, "Now go to sleep, or your father will come up and read some of his poems." We could hear the groaning as they burrowed beneath the duvet. Oh no, not another night of magical word juggling at the hands of a consummate craftsman. Any of you wear contact lenses at all? Oh, happy. A lot of people wear contact lenses, yeah. I was a problem to myself. There's a poem to contact lenses. We were never really suited, were we? A relationship that was bound to fail. I lacked the willpower. Persevere, persevere, was the optician's mantra. Over the years, 5 in all, 4 wearing glasses, I seem to recall. Putting you in was always a problem. Being short-sighted, I could seldom hit the target, and you would slide over the cornea and disappear from the screen like a lost email, unread and irretrievable. Getting you out was even worse. Last thing at night, I would jab an eyeball impatiently like a doorbell, sending you into orbit around the cosmos, before landing, I imagined, on the dark side of the brain. Or perhaps sliding down a nasal passage into the trachea to end up lodged in a lung. Remember the time I found you on the floor of the bathroom and thought I'd coughed you up? Poor. The pity is, we didn't meet sooner. Who knows what heights I might have achieved on the tennis court or the rugby field? But by the time you appeared on the scene was an accustomed blur. Eventually, my aim improved and lenses softened. But by then, I'd given up on you. Now my sporting days are over, and girls make fun, not passes. Although tempted by the occasional fling, I face the fact I'm stuck with glasses. Yeah, thank you. I don't know if there are any poetry please listeners here. Yes, oh good. That was great. I really enjoy presenting poetry please. And last year, well, this year, it was his 30th year since it's been running. So I decided to write a poem for it. And I wrote, I call it a cento, where you use lines from other poems and stitch them together. So I've used lines from rather favourite poems used on Poetry Please. And you probably recognise perhaps lines by Caroline Duffy, John Cooper Clarke, Thomas Hardy and so forth. To Poetry Please. What a daunting pleasure it has been over the years to sit in a studio and present you to the nation at bbc.co.uk to celebrate poetry. 7 buxom women abreast, staggering and sliding on icebound road. The red wheelbarrow, a boy falling from the sky. Dapple things, borrow groves and runcible spoons. The secret ministry of frost, full moons and little Frida. Rainbows and the liquefaction of Julia's clothes. To celebrate the joy of socks, love in the back of vans, sing the body reclining and the warming of her pearls, the way we were and the way we will be, growing old, wearing purple, a joy to behold. And let us not forget the vacuum cleaner and the Ford Cortina BS82LR. More feel good than gil good. Rhyme, I like that stuff. Let us sleep now. To poetry, please, a little memento. Some of your favourite lines stitched into a cento. And this is, thank you. It's a poem to religion. I remember talking to some BBC people before, and the question was asked about faith and writing. And I remember when I was at school growing up, all my friends were, you know, Catholics and went to church, Christians, and you used to read about the martyrs, you know, being stoned for being Christian or being stoned for believing in God and, you know, crucified and so forth. And you think, gosh, glad I don't live in those times. And then you read so much now in the papers, as you know, and the in the media and so forth, as if, you know, believing in something, on having a way of life that's religious, that there's something wrong with you, as if you're stupid. Sorry, Richard. And so, anyway, so writing is often difficult to state your case, but you hope all your work is, in a sense, comes from that spark. Here's a poem to religion. Thank you, religion, for helping me believe that I'm living a charmed life. Touch wood, no disasters so far. I've more friends than foes, 4 children and a wife who is always at the heart of things. Pay my dues and chant a prayer to keep them safe. In times of despair, an alarm bell rings, and I wonder if perhaps it's all a con. But then somewhere within, a small voice sings. Mumbo jumbo, before I can tell, it's gone. Brainwashed, you're in my DNA. We've no idea. Against all odds, we soldier on. People cleverer than me think I'm naive, that God is dead, that when it ends, it ends. But thank you, religion, for helping me believe. Thank you. This is to my final poem. And I was thinking about the idea, you know, what was the last poem you're actually writing, you know, with something off when you drop dead? What is it? You know, could be, is it a really good poem or is it really, you know, crappy? And but it will not be the poem's fault, you know, because you are what you are, and you are every you're writing and developing. So it's not one thing. Anyway, I'm muttering on to my final poem. You, my friend, have a lot on your plate. Have you the gravitas? Can you bear the weight of a life summation? Can you detain the fleeting muse? With quiet courage, relay the sad news to the waiting nation? Or are you just another patch on the quilt? Another nervous scratch on the poetry table? Spare me the guilt of a commission, a bar mitzvah, or an ad for television. Always too available. An epithalamium to someone distantly related. A heartfelt elegy, redrafted and updated. A haiku sent by text. The birthday greeting dashed off on a train. The consolation, fleeting and vain, that your best poem will be the next. A nonsense verse to fill an empty page. Something about a teapot in a cage. The hairbrush and the tortoise. Or are you unfinished? Manuscript on the floor, pen prized from a demented claw, frozen in rigor mortis. Don't worry, final poem. You're not on the last leg of a relay race carrying the baton, the prize within your grasp. There are no prizes. Laurels turn to dust. So let's keep it simple. You're just my final poem, my last gasp. Poem called Carpe Diem. Lovely expression, Carpe Diem, isn't it? You know, seize the day, yeah. I always thought it was something to do with fish. It was a sort of notice you might see in ancient Rome. You know, you walk around the forum, be hungry, and see a restaurant. Carpe Diem, fish of the day. They're lovely, I got to know it. Puer, Carpe Diem, cum vino. Yeah, you got the idea. Anyway. Carpe diem. On reaching 60, I decided to live every day as if it were my last, but it didn't last. After 3 days of lying in bed in a darkened room, I tore off the oxygen mask, opened the curtains, and sacked the nurse. There was more to life, surely, than worrying about when it would end. And how? The secret was carpe diem. So out I went to seize the day, to catch it unawares and hug it, to bathe in its light, to enjoy every minute. But the day kept me at arm's length, didn't want to be touched, bobbed and weaved until it dwindled away. At 1 a.m., I ended up in the bar of the carpe diem, drunk and counting the cost. Another day wasted, another chance lost. Then, who should walk in, looking the worse for wear, but the nurse? We hugged and staggered back home. Drew the curtains. We climbed into bed. On a more serious note, of course, with age brings its own problems. There's a poem about dementia, about Alzheimer's. But it wasn't... Yeah, it was... Yes, it's about Alzheimer's, but it's also, in a sense, I love poem. But you know what I mean? It's you don't say, I'm going to write a poem about Alzheimer's. You don't say, I'm going to write a poem about this. You just write a poem from some sort of feelings within. And this began as a love poem, but it became about that. And it's called A Fine Romance. Excuse me, darling, in advance, for the slow, macabre dance I may one day lead you into. Holding you too tight for comfort and whispering endearments. If I should call you by another's name, a lover's perhaps from years ago, don't be startled, it's just a slip of the moonlight. And when the music grows louder and the dance goes faster, and losing my balance I stumble, words spinning off in all directions, don't be embarrassed, it's just a slip of the darkness. For when the blizzard rages and snow settles on words, the sense becomes frozen, language hallucinates. Listen, that's me out there, howling at the Scrabble board. Should I fail to recognize you? Curse, complain, step on your toes. Forgive me, I didn't mean to. For this is a fine romance, despite the slow, macabre dance I may one day lead you into. Thank you. Just one more dark poem, then a lighten up. A friend of mine was very ill, and he emailed me saying, "We could hide under bushes and hide in the shade, and then death won't find us." And I wrote this back called Nice Try. You say if we hid under bushes or darted from shade to shade, then we might get by unnoticed. Unlikely. We are vastly outnumbered. As we speak, they're out there, scythes at the ready, playing hide and seek. Me under a bush, you in the shade, someone counting to 10, sharpening a blade. Survivor. Every day I think about dying, about disease, starvation, violence, terrorism, war, the end of the world. It helps keep my mind off things. Thank you. There's a new poem. Do you know a famous poem called When Did You Last See Your Father? Good. You know, I know it hangs in Liverpool. I was brought up on it. It hangs in Liverpool. And, you know, it's set in the Civil War in England, isn't it? And there's a young boy, little boy, remember, wearing a blue velvet suit, standing on it. And there's the roundheads are all questioning him, soldiers. And in the corners, mum and his sister are crying. So I thought, write a poem about it. When did you last see your father? And when did you last see your father? Never. The officer leaned forward, bemused. Don't get all cavalier with me. We roundheads are not easily amused. Time is the essence, so answer them quick, or it's over the table and out with the stick. When did you last see your father? I repeat. The boy mumbled now, white as a sheet. A soldier. He disappeared before I was born, leaving my mother and sister forlorn. For I am a bastard, sir, and I carry the shame. Your father's the bastard. Now tell me his name. The boy went silent, recalling the name of him. Cromwell, Oliver. Do you know what became of him? You had to be there, really. Joe mentioned Caroline Duffy, a friend of mine. Caroline's one of her, I'm a great fan of Caroline's, old friend, great fan of her work. And do you know the book, The World's Wife, by Caroline Duffy, where she took the voice of men, the women married to famous men. So Mrs. Darwin, you know, Mrs. Midas, that sort of thing. It's really very well. So I thought, I'd like to do one for the men who marry to famous women. I'll kick off with Mr. Nightingale. Coughing and sneezing, wishing I were dead. No angel of mercy at the foot of my bed. Suffering, I'm here in a room cold and damp, while you're in the Crimea, swanning round with a lamp. Comforting soldiers who thrill to your beauty, your nursing skills, your devotion to duty. Oh, Florence, it happens again and again. As soon as I'm poorly, you're on the next train. To some distant frontier, the far-flunger the better, where you send a get-well card, the occasional letter. Oh, Florrie, I'm sorry, but this is my prayer, to charge with the Light Brigade and expire in your care. Anyway. I always was inspired by Joan of Arc. An amazing story, amazing lady, Joan of Arc. We hear a lot about her. We don't hear so much about her husband, Mr. of Arc. And even though the poems about Mr. Arc, I'm really talking about those voices, remember the famous voices that spoke to her. So I'm really addressing the voices. Anyway, Mr. of Arc. She was always a bit of a tomboy. I knew that when we got married. Not for her a bridal gown of white satin, bouquet and veil, but a helmet, axe and cloak of chainmail. Should have been a nun if you asked me, but no convent would have her. She was no good at taking orders, even holy ones. And to be honest, the hooded falcon on her wrist did her no favours. At 16, you came along, the voices. Tu es les anglais. What's the point? Why not tell us something useful like how to make a decent cassoulet, or where to buy a goose that lays golden eggs. When you told her to fight at Compiègne, I begged her to turn a deaf ear. But no, there's too much at stake, she said. Oh, you're so clever. Many a true word, as she turned out. Wounded, captured, and thrown into prison. And where were you at Rouen when she was in the dock accused of heresy? You could have pleaded her innocence. Instead, you clammed up, watched dumbly as she was sentenced and burnt as a witch. But for you, she'd have stayed with me on our farm in Domremy and raised a family, lived contentedly and died in obscurity. No martyrdom at 19, no celebrity or voices. You have much to answer for. And the last one, Famous Five. Thank you. Remember the Famous Five books? Did you like the Famous Five? Enid Blyton, yes, I was a great writer, Enid Blyton. This is Mr. Blyton. We were happy, by Jove. Remember our honeymoon? Cottage overlooking Kirin Cove. Bun-filled days and fizzy nights that ended all too soon. I blame the children. Not ours, but Julian, Dick, Anne and George. Appearing out of nowhere in search of adventure. And you happy to oblige, packing them off to an island in a rowing boat. They had a super time by all accounts and demanded more. Even Timmy the dog wagged his tail, waiting for you to throw him another story, which you did. Smugglers, wasn't it? We saw less and less of each other. All day you spent alone on the beach, skimming words across the waves like pebbles, before locking yourself in the study with dog biscuits and bottles of ginger beer. Each night in bed, I felt for your body, only to feel the felt of Noddy. And the rough surge of PC plod. The fear of separation, the domestic friction. On my knees, I prayed to the god of fiction. May they be asphyxiated in an underground tunnel, run over by a ghost train. George, no longer the tomboy, molested by Julian. Let there be gore. Let smugglers bury them alive, the boat overturn. Let five famous skeletons be washed up on a distant shore. But my prayers came to naught. So one morning, while you were building a haunted castle at your desk, I packed a suitcase and walked out. The sound of jeering made me turn, and there they were on the porch, four smoking woodbines, one pissing against my bicycle. Thank you. Couple more poems. I was a great fan. What really got me started off poetry years ago was listening to Under Milkwood, Donald Thomas's Under Milkwood, Richard Burton reading it, wonderful. And having been to Larn, you know, where Donald Thomas lived, and been to the place called Brown's Hotel, that's the pub where he used to drink with Catelyn, his wife. And they always say, oh yes, Donald Thomas used to come in regularly, sit in the corner and listen, eavesdrop on people's conversations, write that down, and put them into his play, which I'm not too sure about. So I imagine, here's the bar, Dylan's over in the corner, I'm the landlord, and somebody comes in on a dark and stormy night. "Well, if it isn't Die the Fish. Had a good day, Boyle?"
"Aye, I've been out on the slow black fishing boat bobbing sea. And I got a thirst like a dredger. So give me a pint of stout, will you?
It's quiet in here tonight."
"Aye. You can hear the owls sleeping in the streets. In the slow, deep salt and silent black bandage night.
That'll be 1 shilling and 4 pence, please."
"I see Dylan the eavesdrop is up to his old tricks. Pretending to be so busy writing poems, he can't hear us.
What's this?
Good evening, Mr. Thomas. Kathleen in London, is she?"
"That's right, Di. Yes, she'll be back home tomorrow."
"Bet you can't wait, eh? Whacking thighed and piping hot. Thunderbolt brassed and barnacle breasted. Flailing up the cockles with eyes like blow lamps and scooping low over a lonely hot water bottle body."
"That's right, Di, yes. Barnacle breasted, that's one word, is it?" "Hey, you. Anyone like cats?" "I got a call, who is going out from a publisher. Said, Roger, do you have any poems about cats?" I said, "I do." I didn't, actually, at the time. I didn't. She's a pity we could make this lovely book, Cat Poems, Cat Illustrations, and all the money is going to the CPL, as it was called then. I said, "What's CPL?" "It's the Cats Protection League." So I said, "Well, I'll have a go, write a poem." So I wrote this poem. "Midnight, knock at the door. Open it, better had. Three heavy cats, mean and bad. They offer protection. I ask, what for? The boss cat snarls. You know the score. Listen, man, and listen good, if you want to stay in the neighborhood. Pay your dues or the toms will call and wail each night on the backyard wall. Mangle the flowers, and as for the lawn, a smelly minefield awaits you each dawn. These guys meant business, without a doubt. Three cans of tuna, I handed them out. They then disappeared like bats into hell, those bad, bad cats from the CPL." Hey. Then when I found out what it was all about, really, I wrote some more. Just read one more of these naughty cat poems. This one's called Mafia Cats. "We're the Mafia Cats, Bugsy, Franco and Tony. We're crazy for pizza with hot pepperoni. We run all the rackets from gambling to vice. On St. Valentine's Day, we massacre mice. We always wear shades to show that we're meanies, big hats and sharp suits and drive Lamborghinis. We're the Mafia Cats, Bugsy, Franco and Tony. Love Sicilian wine and cheese macaroni. But we have a secret. And if you dare tell, you'll end up with the kitten at the bottom of the well. Or covered in concrete and thrown into the deep. For this is one secret you really must keep. We're the Cosa Nostra, run the scams and the fiddles. But at home we are Mopsy, Ginger and Tiddles." Hey. This is a bit silly, really. But it's about we all make mistakes, don't we? We're all, don't we? That's one of the things. We all make mistakes. We're all, you know, capable of it. And occasionally I make mistakes. So this poem called One Mistake After Another. "My first mistake was to do the cooking in the nude. My second mistake was to fry the sausages inside the tent. My third mistake was to leap outside once it had caught fire. My fourth mistake was to land on the rear end of a sheep. My fifth mistake was to cling to her fleece as she bucked and writhed
and raced across the field. My sixth mistake was to wave when the farmer pointed his camera. My seventh mistake was to close my eyes as I flew over the hedge. My eighth mistake was to crash land on the farmer's daughter, sunbathing topless on the lawn. My ninth mistake was to attempt mouth-to-mouth resuscitation while trying to get her bikini top back on. My tenth mistake was to run deep into the magic forest and hide until nightfall. My 11th mistake was to break into the cottage, eat the porridge, and fall asleep in the bed that was just right. My 12th mistake was not to notice Goldilocks until next morning, when the farmer, the police, and the three birds arrived. Thank you. I always remember growing up in Liverpool, and one of the things that I always remember my grandmother saying, and my aunties married, or my married aunties, mother, father, one of the things they always said was, I never want to be a burden on my children. I'm never going to be a burden on my children. Remember that? That was the feeling. Now that was very good, very admirable. But having had four children myself and two still at home, just can't get rid of them, I thought, sod it. little prayer called Payback Time. Oh Lord, let me be a burden on my children. For long they've been a burden upon me. May they fetch and carry, clean and scrub, and do so cheerfully. Let them take it at turns at putting me up. Nice sunny rooms at the top of the stairs, with a walk-in bath and lift installed, at great expense. Theirs. Insurance against the body blows of time. Isn't that what having children's all about? To bring them up knowing that they owe you and can't contract out. What's money for but to spend on their schooling? Designer clothes, mindless hobbies, usual stuff. And as soon as they're earning, off they go. Well, enough's enough. It's been a blessing watching them develop. The parental pride we felt as each one grew. But Lord, let me be a burden on my children and on my children's children too. Two poems to finish with. Thank you very much for turning up and being with me. Two poems. This is a very new poem. And I've got this idea that all children are poets before they go to school, in a sense. And what I mean by, you know, children have imagination. Imagination, the wonderful imagination they have. And the way they link up things that are not linkable up. And, which is fine. But often so much education now is to do with, you know, correcting the imagination. This is not bad, it's difficult to explain, but as if there are answers to everything. You know, there's a right way and a wrong way. And if you're too imaginative, you can get into trouble. So this little short poem, before my final one, is called Look, Daddy, the Candle is Crying. Look, Daddy, the candle is crying. Is it, my dear? And are they tears of joy for the birthday boy, hunched above the cake, impatient for the count of three? Or does it weep at the thought of its journey into darkness, ending with a hiss of smoke in a puddle of grease? No, the candle is not crying. The heat of the flame generated by the wick absorbs the liquid and pulls it upward where it is vaporized. What you mistake for tears are merely droplets of melting paraffin wax. Now off to bed you go and stop being silly. And this is... the way things are. No, the candle is not crying. It cannot feel pain. Even telescopes, like the rest of us, grow bored. Bubble gum will not make the hair soft and shiny. The duller the imagination, the faster the car. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. When the sky is looking the other way, do not enter the forest. No, the wind is not caused by the rushing of clouds. An excuse is as good a reason as any. A lighthouse launch will not go far. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. No, old people do not walk slowly because they have plenty of time. Gardening books, when buried, will not flower. though lightly worn, a crown may leave a scar. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. No, the red woolly hat has not been put on the railing to keep it warm. When one glove is missing, both are lost. Today's craft fur is tomorrow's car boot sale. The guitarist gently weeps, not the guitar. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. Pebbles work best without batteries. The deck chair will fail as a unit of currency. Even though your shadow is shortening, it does not mean you're growing smaller. Moonbeams, sadly, will not survive in a jar. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. For centuries, the bullet remained quietly confident that the gun would be invented. A drowning surrealist will not appreciate the concrete lifebelt. No guarantee my last goodbye is au revoir. I'm your father, and this is the way things are. Do not become a prison officer unless you know what you're letting someone else in for. The thrill of being a shower curtain will soon pull. No trusting hand awaits the falling star. I'm your father. I'm sorry, but this is the way things are. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We have 5 minutes left for any questions you might have about anything. When you've got the house lights on, is that possible, please? All right, yeah. If you have any questions, if not, doesn't matter. It's all right, you know. Yes, one right in front, that's a good one.
Yeah. As a poet, how do you feel about what education or what academics do to poetry?
What academics do to poetry, yes. Sometimes I think a lot of teachers are not afraid of poetry, what they consider poetry, and I think there's over-reliance sometimes on, you know, the classics. Now, I don't mean that, obviously, classics there for us, but I think teachers can learn about Donne, read an essay about Donne and Tennyson and regurgitate it. I don't know. I think it's important, but I think there's so much more to do, again, with creativity in schools, and I think having... Did I read somewhere Kenneth Robinson, Professor Robinson, said there's something like 65% of children in primary schools now, probably more, will end up doing jobs that at the moment do not exist. It's true. I mean, this is true. They do not exist. Things are changing so fast. So how do you educate people for this? And one of these is the ways is through imagination, through creativity, this, which makes you more adaptable, you know, especially with the internet. If you want information, it is there. Thank you. Summer with Monica, yes. There was my first book was a book called Summer with Monica, and the title came from, I remember going, when I was in Liverpool, saw the title, the poster for a film by Ingmar Bergman, Summer with Monica. Remember the beautiful title of a girl on this poster? And I was writing poems, love poems at the time, about different girls, about falling in and out of love when you're 18, 19, 20. And having the name Monica, I just took it out the air, and I was able then to write poems more feelingly because it wasn't a real person. So it traces the breakup of a relationship, you know, a very passionate relationship, living together and then breaking up. And it was like sort of fictitious. And it did echo what my life became for a while. And that's all right. I do revisit it sometimes, and some of the poems I don't read it anymore aloud because I feel I'm too old, you know what I mean? It sounds like an old man reading young man's poems. I feel funny about that. But I look at it now, and it does take me back. Thank you for that, reminding me of it. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, I think that the Mezzi Sound book, yeah, did have that effect on people. I think poetry had been seemed to be a bit elsewhere, belonged to other people, didn't it, I always feel? I always felt poetry didn't quite belong to me, and meeting up with Brian Patton and Adrian Henry and people, and other people around about the country as well were doing it, you know, trying to speak for your mum and dad and your friends and write poetry that could be entertaining as well as moving and all those things. I never saw the point of writing poetry that is indecipherable, really. Poems and Pints. Yeah, I remember that. Poems and Pints. That's right. Yeah, I vaguely remember that. And it was in a pub, wasn't it? And people get up and read poems. Yeah, I mean, you know what film people are terrified of, this spoken word
or the face. You know, if ever I'm asked to do a poem on television, it happened a few weeks ago, it was children's television. Roger, great, you got a new book. You're going to do a poem for us. Yeah. How long is it? Well, it's only about, it's no more than 10 seconds, is it? Because, you know, children, you know, people can't concentrate. Or maybe, what's the poem about? You can tell us what, then we get some pictures. I said, well, that's all right, I'll do it, just, you know. And then they do this, and they take a chance on you going straight to camera for 10 seconds. And then they have someone with a bloody hedgehog comes on for 20 minutes, you know, the hedgehog crawling all over them, and they go, ah, that's good, that was good television. But it's all to do with that, I think. They want it's the visuals, isn't it? Poetry's a bit static, but it's all in their mind. Yes, one more. Yes? Well, the poem called The Leader, which goes, this is one of the things I remember, called The Leader. I want to be the leader, I want to be the leader. Can I be the leader? Can I? I can. Promise? Promise? Yippee, I'm the leader, I'm the leader. Okay, what should we do? So, you're quite right. I mean, it's couched in sort of the way children speak, isn't it? And I was thinking of that. But Tony Blair had it in his office, apparently, and some people, politicians, use it. Sure. Okay, class of that. So it's about people who seem to know and don't. And this is when you're younger, you always think people do know. I always thought other people knew better than I did. I still do. It's hard not to come to terms with that. You know, that, and people give you respect and you don't deserve it. And so forth and so on. Listen, I'd love to answer questions more, but I suppose it's nice outside. And just like to thank you very much for my first visit here to Greenbelt. And it's been great. Thank you much indeed. Good night. All right, good night. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.